The BBC presents My Word. Here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dennis Norden, Dennis Powell, and Frank Muir. Round one tries to test their respective vocabularies. For 2 marks, can you give me the meaning of the following words? Beginning with Dillis Power. Dillis, what is expurgifaction?
Expurg.
Expurgifaction.
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 Waking up and spitting.
Yes.
It's not.
Good for you. You get your 2 marks straight away. It's the process of waking up after sleep, like Rip Van Winkle, who took 20 years to do it. And it is a Latin word, late Latin word, meaning the fact or state of being awakened. You can spit if you like, but that's not...
Not necessary.
Not necessary.
Well.
Now, Dennis Norden. Dennis, what's a borborygm? B-O-R-B-O-R-Y-G-M. Borborygm.
B-O-R-B-O-R-Y-G-M.
Borborygm.
Borborygm. Good heavens. Borbury. It's a stratagem for getting rid of bores.
You wouldn't like it. Gulliver. It isn't a...
No, it isn't Brobdingnagian. No.
It sounds horrible.
Literary?
It could be.
I sat next to the Duchess at tea. Can you help?
No, Jack, it's impressive.
It's your... She was pleasant as pleasant could be.
Everyone blames it on me.
It's literary, I gather. Lear?
No, and everybody blamed it on me. Everyone blamed it on me. Do you remember? A little bit.
Oh, is it saying pardon?
Yes.
Then is it a kind of eructation or...
Yes.
Or burp?
Yes, it's a bit lower down than that, but I'll give you...
Oh.
Not farther. One out of two. It's a rumbling in the bowels... Or an attack of collywobbles. Greek word. Anne Scott James, what is a hopress? H-A-R-P-R-E-S-S. Hopress.
H-A-R-P?
R-E-S-S. Hopress.
Oh, I should think it's a mixture between a harpy and a temptress.
Well, no, you're right.
A female of an evil nature.
A female doing something when you've nearly got to...
Siren songing.
Playing the harp?
Yes. It's a lady who plays the harp. One harp in. Frank Muir, what is the haboob? H-A-B-O-O-B. Haboob.
Haboob, Middle Eastern.
Yes.
It's a mouthpiece of a hubble bubble.
That's a nice thought. You might be, in fact, inhaling a hubble bubble while it happened, but it would make it very uncomfortable.
Haboob.
It's rather like a simoom. Do you know what a simoom is?
It's a wind.
Yes.
It's a dust storm.
Yes, that's right.
It's a dust storm.
Right. It's a dreaded wind in Egypt and the Sudan. It blows sand into everybody's faces, including picture postcard salesmen. It's rather like the simoom. I think that blows in the opposite direction. 2 marks. Well, before we begin the next round, I read out a quotation for each team to write down. And the two women members of the teams will go on studying those quotations because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, yours is, it's a long lane that has no turning. And Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, your quotation, a nod is as good as a wink to a blind horse. And then the last round, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. And next we have a round of nouns of assembly, that is, words which denote a group of something, for instance, like a gaggle of geese or a school of porpoises. And here are some nouns of assemblage, and they mainly concern birds or beasts. Now, you can split the marking a bit here. 1 mark if you can identify whether it is birds or beasts, and 2 marks if you can name the actual species of the animal concerned. Dennis Powell, Your group is known as a kindle. K-I-N-D-L-E.
A kindle?
Yes.
Of sticks?
No.
A kindle?
Yes.
Kittens?
Yes.
Oh.
It's a kindle of kittens. A cat, when it's pregnant, is known as being in kindle. And I don't snort. I think this is a bit harder. Your group is known as a fessning. F-E-S-N-Y-N-G.
That's a group.
Yes, it's a group.
What label do they record for?
Rabbits.
Fessning.
Does anything to do with hawking?
They record for rabbits.
It sounds vaguely sort of Lapland. Is it like a fessning of caribou?
It'd be very nice. No,
ferritch.
It's here at half. Yes.
Ferritch.
That's
ferritch.
What I wanted. Yes.
Well, well done.
2 marks it is. A fessning of ferrets.
Oh, good. Yes. I think you should do a lap of honour for that.
And Anne Scott James, yours is a bit bigger and a bit harder, I think. Your group is known as a sleuth, like Sherlock Holmes, sleuth.
Oh, well, this must be things that follow things. Greyhounds.
No, much bigger.
Big greyhounds.
Jackals.
That's a good one, but it isn't there.
Vultures.
No, it's not a bird, it's an animal.
No, animal, yes, that's
it's
right.
It's an animal. What are big animals? We've heard of tigers, whales.
We found them in the Rockies.
Bears.
Yes.
Bears.
One and a half. A sleuth of bears. It'd be awfully horrid to see as many of those as you could think of together. And frankly, and yours is very easy, a group known as a charm.
A charm of tits. charm of finches.
Yes, which kind?
Green.
Green, gold.
Yes.
Gold finches. Charm of finches is an expression I've heard.
No, it's a goldfinch. No, it's a pattern they make in the air. If you see them flying, you get this sudden flash of goldfinches, and it's called a charm of goldfinch. They look very nice, too. Come on.
I made up one of these collective nouns once. It was an erection of property developers.
Well, now we have a nice jolly round about death, in particular about unnatural death, and not all of them. For 2 marks, tell me how, you needn't spare me any details, the following people came to their respective ends. Dilys Powell, Aeschylus.
Aeschylus had the great misfortune of having something dropped in his head.
Do you remember what it was?
It was a tortoise.
Why do you think that happened? And this is not part of the question. You'll get your
he had marks. A bald head.
Yes, and what was...
And an eagle, yes, thought he was something else. He dropped the
stone
in his head.
So
he
stone. Jolly good. Well done. Aeschylus was the great tragedian, and when I think he was about 60-something, this silly eagle wanted to break up a tortoise like a thrush breaks a snail's shell, dropped it on his bald head, thinking it was a nice rock and would break the tortoise. Instead of breaking the tortoise, he broke Aeschylus.
Have you looked through the small print of your insurance policies? How many of us are covered?
Sorry, I'm with the eagle insurance.
Dennis Norton, Francis Bacon, the 16th century philosopher, lawyer, Lord Chancellor of England.
He died because Shakespeare came round and said, I hear you've been putting it about. he pierced him with a quill pen.
It's almost equally extraordinary, in fact.
I have no doubt, Jack.
He died rather curiously of pneumonia when he stepped out of his coach on a wintry day to stuff a chicken with snow in order to make the first experiments into refrigeration. So you owe your fridges to Lord Francis Bacon. One more.
I thought Bacon was cured.
Not yet time. Anne Scott James. King Edward IV's brother, George.
He wasn't the Duke of Clarence.
Yes.
Was he? Oh, he was drafted at Bath of Marsley Way.
Yes. That's it. George of the House of York, the King Edward IV's brother, was killed by first, second, and third murder, if I remember from Shakespeare, who upended him after stabbing him in a large butt of Malmsey wine, and he perished in the tower. Franckner, Bell Elmore, B-E-L-L-E, and then E-L-M-O-R-E.
She was poisoned by her husband.
Yes.
Who was Dr. Crippen.
Yes.
Isn't it Bella? Was it Bella?
I think it's Bella. And what happened after?
Well, he was the first man. He poisoned her, and then he went to America on a steamboat with his mistress.
Yes.
And in fact was apprehended by the use of the wireless telegraph.
For the first time, yes.
For the first time.
Yes.
Well, the only time he was apprehended.
First time wireless telegraph was used for that purpose, sorry. Yes, that's right. Bell Elmore was Dr. Crippen's wife, and after he poisoned her, he cut her up in small pieces and buried the pieces in the coal cellar. Where she was afterwards found. Well, now we come to the last round, and I go back to the quotations I gave the teams earlier in the program. For 2 marks, Phyllis Power, the origin of your quotation, please. It's a long lane that has no turning.
It's a proverb.
Give a shot at the book in which it first occurs.
English proverb?
Yes, English proverb. Yes.
English proverb.
Oh, I think it's good enough.
Ray.
Yes, Ray, it is.
1670.
Yes, he's put it slightly different. It's a long run that has no turns, but it became it's a long lane that has no turning. Now, Anne Scott James, the origin of yours. A nod's as good as a wink to a blind horse.
I should think that's a proverb.
Well, it became one, but there is a quite straightforward origination of this
well,
one.
Well, I put the full in King Lear I have written down.
That's jolly good. Go north of the border.
Go north of the border. Somebody's Scotch.
Yes. Essentially.
I should think it was Scotch.
1 out of 2 it was. It's in 1818. It comes in Walter Scott's Heart of Midlothian. Ye understand my meaning. Aye, sir, a nod's as good as a wink to a blind horse. And later on, a wink is as good as a nod. The shortened form of the proverb comes in the Oxford Book of Proverbs. And dates back to about 1802. Well, now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their improbable explanations of how these quotations came into being. And for this round only, the marks will go to whichever unlikely story receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir and his quotation, "It's a long lane that has no turning."
Never mind about that. a lecture. Absolutely everything there is to know about beds. Beds were talked about a lot in literature. Shakespeare, for instance. Those of you who have visited the cottage at Stratford-on-Avon will have remarked how small, how tiny the bed is there. And in fact, Stowe's Chronicles record that Shakespeare was asked by his friends Robert Greene and Marlowe in the tavern, in the Mermaid Tavern, how he and his wife managed on such a small bed, to which Shakespeare replied, "Anne hath a way." You find many references to sleep and bed and dreams in Shakespeare, and the Elizabethans had a herbal ointment containing saffron, which they used to rub on their chests to induce sound sleep and sweet dreams. There's a reference to it, you remember, in Hamlet. He says, to sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. Another reference to beds in poetry comes in a very delightful early Victorian poem, recording a girl's memory of her bedroom in the country. It said, I remember the house where I was born, the little window where the sun came peeping in at morn. Literary research has now established that it was the squire's son, and he got 3 months. Whole literary books have been written on the subject of sleep. H.G. Wells' definitive work, Kipps. Now, bedwear, pyjamas. Some couples wear pyjamas, but in that case they have to be very big ones. Pyjamas
Pajamas are come from Persia. It's an old Persian word, pajamas, which means pajamas. And the Persian poet Omar Khayyam, who I'm afraid is dead, is no longer with us. He wrote that the caliphs of Persia, when they'd had 8 children, had their pajamas sewn up. Hence, in the Rubaiyat, you find the old Persian proverb, "A stitch in time saves 9." The nicest moment of all in bed is the Saturday morning lie-in. The trouble is with me is that you've got to stay absolutely inert. You've got to sink into a kind of coma. As soon as you start twitching and fiddling, your wife said, "Come on, you said you'd clear out the loft," and so forth, you know, and it's all destroyed. You've got to stay absolutely not moving a muscle, and that's very difficult, because some of my sheets are darned. This is due to the fact that big toe. I have great difficulty in cutting my big toenails. Little toenails, no problem. Big toenails with the clippers takes both hands, eventually terrific heave. There's a tremendous click. Throw yourself flat on the floor to avoid the ricochet. Ding-dong, bing-bong-bong. Tooth glass mirror. What happens to it? Where do these little crescent shapes go? Do they embed themselves in the brickwork? To be dug out afterwards by archaeologists? Cromwellian bullets at Bosworth Field? So I don't cut toenails. So toenails dig a little hole in sheet and they're darned. What happens? The lie-in Saturday morning, lovely little roughness up against the toe. You've just got to twitch it with a toenail. And then there's, oh, you're fidgeting again. Come on, some of us have got to get to work and it's finished. So the only hope for the best moment in bed is to have pristine sheets, absolutely clear, with no of those little interesting interruptions to explore with your big toe. So if anybody said to me, "Hand on your heart, Frank, what is the most enjoyable moment in bed?" I would say, it's a long lie-in that has no darning.
Well, now we all know why Shakespeare left Anne Hathaway only his second best bed. And we go on to Dennis Norden. And if you remember, his quotation was, "A nod's as good as a wink to a blind horse."
Come with me now, through the magic of broadcasting, backwards in time to the dark days of 1942. Well, in 1942, I was not as I am today. What I was at that time was a WOP. A WOP was an RAF term for a wireless operator. And that was me in 1942 in the RAF, number 1615358, wireless operator UT. UT being another ingenious RAF abbreviation. It meant under training. Now this training, the RAF had calculated that the maximum period necessary to turn even the most dim-witted of civilians into a fully competent wireless operator was no longer than 3 months. And at the time of which I speak, I had been on the course for a year and a half. Now, before anyone starts posting in white feathers, there was a reason for this. You see, before they pass you out as a wireless operator, qualified wireless operator, you had to undergo tests proving that you were able to read Morse code signals in 2 different ways. Now, one way was orally, by which I don't mean through the mouth. I mean by listening to them through your ears. If that last sentence sounds unnecessarily explicit, I mention it because I do happen to have very good ears. And to this day, I still find myself hearing Morse in all sorts of unexpected things. For example, do you remember Dragnet? Dum, da-dum, dum. Well, that still sounds to me like da, di-da, dit, which is in fact the sound of the letters T-R in Morse. Isn't it a useful gift? See, but it was the other way that you had to be able to read Morse that was causing me in 1942 to be, as far as wireless operating was concerned, what you might call a late developer. Because what you also had to do was prove to them that you could read Morse visually. Now let me explain what that test implied. They stood you on top of a hill where you looked across a valley at another hill. And on top of that other hill was a senior NCO. He held what is called, or was called in those days, an Aldis lamp, a sort of bright lantern, which he proceeded to blink on and off at you. And the alternation of long flashes and short flashes formed Morse code letters, which they expected me, at that distance, to be able to distinguish and write down. But which, as it happened, I was utterly unable even to see. The whole thing to me was just a sort of vague, flickering, indistinguishable, vaguely luminous blur. Well, my mates found a very ingenious way to put into effect that old maxim, if at first you don't succeed, cheat. You see, what they did, what happened with this test, is while you were taking it, all the other trainees had to stand at least 10 paces behind you, so there was no possibility of them whispering the letters to you as they were being blinked out on that other hill. So what did my mates do? They got hold of a very long stick of bamboo. And what my mates did with it was this. All the while that I was being given the Aldis lamp test, they kept prodding me in the back with the stick. A soft prod for a short blink of the lamp, a hard prod for a long blink. So that in this way, in those terms, the TR of the Dragnet theme would come out hard, soft, hard, soft. Do you understand? Well, not only did I pass, I came out top of my entry. Admittedly, I still have to go to the osteopath once a month to have the damaged rib seen to. But I still think it's a very useful tip, that piece of bamboo, for anybody trying to work out Morse code letters from the blinking of a distant light shining into sighted eyes. Or put it another way, a prod is as good as a blink to a shined Morse.
Ladies and gentlemen, by your vote, Frank Muir just wins the contest of the two stories, and Ian Dillispaugh also win the entire contest. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.